Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam, and welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today, nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario, as we continue our Northern History Week here at ActiveHistory.ca. And today we're going to look at a story from the Yukon in the Klondike Gold Rush that has received plenty of attention in recent years, and that is the story of the Nantuck brothers, who were four men convicted of murder in the late 1890s, two of whom were executed in 1899. The other two died of tuberculosis before they could be executed. And this story has received a lot of attention recently because in 2010, the remains of the two brothers who were executed were found at a construction site in Dawson City. So there's been this renewed interest in the story. And along with that, there is a theatrical production which is coming to Ottawa as part of Northern Scene, which looks at the story of the Nantuck brothers from a different point of view and really re-examines the story and looks at issues of criminal justice in Canadian history. So today we have a three-part podcast for you examining the story from a couple different points of view. And first up, my conversation with Leonard Linklater, the playwright of justice, who I talked to earlier today at Arts Court here in Ottawa. So with that, we welcome into the podcast Leonard Linklater,
yes,
the playwright of justice.
Yes.
Welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'm thrilled to have you here. So Justice, the play, follows the story of the Nantuck brothers. So just a little bit of background on who were the Nantuck brothers. What's their story a little bit?
It's interesting because in First Nations culture, I grew up with my mom and a whole pile of aunties, and my dad and a whole pile of uncles. But, you know, you never knew who was actually related and who wasn't, because everyone was brother, sister, and it's the same, I think, in a lot of Indigenous cultures where you grow up in a community. So it's not very clear whether these young men were actually brothers in the English term or sense of the word. They could have been cousins. They could have just been clan brothers. It's hard to distinguish in Indigenous cultures, First Nations culture. So the Nantuck brothers were from the Southern Lakes region of the Yukon. Southern Lakes, just geographically, White Horse is in the southern Yukon, and about 60 kilometers to the south is where the Southern Lakes begin and go back hundreds of miles. in that region is where these Indigenous peoples, the Tagishquan, have their traditional territory. Just so happens that that's also where most of the traffic came when the gold rush hit. Yeah. So the Nantuck brothers were living in this part of the world for thousands of years, and because of geography, were some of the last to be impacted by the Western world. Even into the 1940s, they were people who had never seen white people before.
Right.
Because it's such an isolated place. Mm. So these people, their contacts would be with the southern Tshone to the north of them and the Tlingit to the south.
So the story of the brothers then is a murder case in which they kill some prospectors. This is the version that gets them executed, that they kill some prospectors. And two of them are hanged, as the other two die of tuberculosis before they're hanged. And so the play, I mean, what was your inspiration behind putting this story into a theatrical production?
Well, my inspiration was really in the 1990s when I first came upon the story. I'd never heard of it before. I was at school in Vancouver doing a degree in Indigenous government studies, and the librarians there knew that I was from the Yukon, and this article came out in a legal journal basically arguing that these men during the Gold Rush were tried in an illegitimate court. Basically, it was a judicial homicide. And I found it very interesting, not not the fact that it was a judicial homicide, but the fact that there is this story from the gold rush. I mean, when you grow up in the Yukon, when you live in the Yukon, that's all you hear about is the gold rush.
Right.
But I've never heard this story before.
Mm.
So I was like, well, at the time we were studying the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and the over-representation of First Nations people within the justice system and why that is, the history behind that, and the dysfunctional relationships there. And I thought, wow, these things, you know, have not changed a lot since contact.
Right.
So I thought this would be a great thing to explore. And when I started exploring it, I found that I was getting way too big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had so many characters.
Yeah.
So I boiled it down to, I had to sit back and ask myself, what is the story? Yeah. And the story is basically the clash of cultures with the miscommunication, lack of communication, and how that results in tragedy for both sides. It's not just, I mean, most people will come in looking at this play as, well, you know, the justice system is really bad for First Nations people, but it wasn't exactly kind to the prospectors
right.
in the first place who actually stumble into a justice system they didn't understand either.
Right.
So it's really a look at the different justice systems and how you can actually get in big trouble without even knowing it, really.
Right. I find it interesting that you say that you'd never really heard the story before until you were studying in Vancouver, because I was wondering if this was maybe a celebrated story in the north, around the Dawson City area, of the Nantauk brothers. But since you say you haven't heard of it, obviously it's not sort of this folkloric type story that you grew up with then.
Well, it wouldn't even be from my culture.
Okay.
It's an indigenous story from the Tagishquan.
Right.
I'm from the Gwich'in, which is in northern Yukon, Alaska, and Northwest Territories in the Mackenzie Delta. So there's quite a geographical separation there. Mm-hmm. So I had to do a lot of research into what Tagishquan culture is and what their beliefs are and what their justice systems, all their systems are. Not only that, but I had to also do that into the system that we live in now.
Right.
And that's what is explored in this.
Mm.
But the whole thing about history is, basically it boils down to one thing. To the victor go the spoils, right?
Yeah.
So those who are in control basically get to write the history.
Sure.
And First Nations have never been in control in this country once the two cultures collided.
Yeah.
Because there's two different, very different mindsets.
Mm.
One's a very peaceful culture and does not believe in conflict until it's forced on them. The other is a very aggressive culture, which believes in, which has at its core exploitation.
Mm.
So the history of the one people is pretty well known within their communities, but not on a wider scale.
Right.
So it's not surprising that we didn't hear of it.
Mm-hmm.
Although it has been documented. And once I started looking into it, I found out that anthropologist Julie Cruikshank had written about it through her discussions with elders of the area. She had heard these stories and had explored them in her own writings.
Mm.
But those are in academic journals, right?
Yeah.
How many academic journals do people read on a daily basis?
That's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And it's interesting when you talk about the disparity between sort of this European colonizing history and then the First Nations history. And it's one of the big issues that's going on right now with the Canadian the Civilization Museum, which is being changed to the Canadian Museum of History, and the fear that amongst the historical community that it's going to present a single narrative of conquests and European expansion, and that's it. And then the First Nations voice will be lost in that story, because the Civilization Museum is one of the few places where that narrative is strong. In First Peoples Hall on the ground floor there. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that dichotomy.
I might take issue with your
term
of strong.
Okay.
I mean, it is one floor on a museum
I mean, within the museum, I mean, it's within the context of just that
building.
No, I've
been there. I've been there. And okay. I've seen it, and I think it is a great, great, you know, place.
Yeah.
But I don't think everyone will get to see it, you know. I mean, the people from the Yukon are not going to be traveling to Ottawa to visit this. What I'm talking about when I'm talking about history and the stories, I mean, do you even know what Ottawa means? You know?
No. It's some of the river, right? Is it the name of the...
Don't ask me.
No, okay.
Here, but I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Do you know what Toronto means?
Yeah. No, I don't. No.
You know, these are all First Nations communities that have been displaced.
Sure.
People who grew up here, the European settlers, don't know that.
Right.
In every community as you go across this country, some community has, not some, lots of communities have been displaced.
Mm-hmm.
And moved to the least productive lands.
Right.
And the names have been adopted or even co-opted or even just forgotten.
Yeah.
And some European guy's name is put on it. You know, yeah. Prince George, who the hell's that? Who cares? You know, who are the people of that area?
Hmm.
So when I'm talking about history, I'm talking about, you know, the realization that you are on walking in the footprints of people who've been here for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my kids are now in university. One's just graduating from university. The other's just starting her university career. But I've always told them that, you know, you come from a people who've been here for 1,000 generations. The best your friends can do is say they've been in that area for 5 generations, maybe.
Right.
You know, we've lived here, survived, prospered, for 1,000 generations.
Yeah.
We had to have something there, some society, some systems, some, you know, justice, education, governance, religion. We had all of that before anyone came along.
Right.
That's all been taken.
Yeah.
So I try to tell them that you got to be proud of who you are. Who you were and who you are.
Mm.
And that's what I'm talking about when I talk history.
Right. And is the play part of that effort then?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's telling the story of history from a new angle. You're looking at it from another perspective.
Yeah.
You're looking at it from the First Nation perspective.
Mm-hmm.
These are historical facts. This is a theatrical, artistic presentation of that, but it's from the perspective of the indigenous peoples.
Mm.
And hopefully, you know, it'll ring true to those people who haven't had their voice out there before.
Right. We're going to talk to Greg Hare in the next part of the podcast and talk to him about the discovery of the remains of the two brothers who were executed. And I'm just wondering what your reaction was when those remains were found a couple of years ago.
It was pretty interesting because at the time we were looking at producing the plane, so it really put a rush on. It sort of lit a fire under us to get it done. The theater company and myself, to really get it done and get it out there. And for me, it was just great. It's wonderful. Like, at least now we know a few other things about these guys. For instance, they both had signs of scurvy, died of tuberculosis, right?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't die of tuberculosis because they were hung.
Yeah.
But, you know, the others probably had the same thing. So really gives you an idea of what they must have went through because it's very painful to have those. But, yeah, it was a couple of things. It was a bit of relief, a little bit of surprise, and a whole lot of pressure.
And the whole I don't know if it was really, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but the whole discussion over what to do with the remains, as someone who had researched it and done some extensive study on it, what was your role in that process?
I had no role.
Okay.
No, I mean, as a journalist, I was interested.
Yeah.
As a playwright, very interested. But as an indigenous person from the far north, it was up to the family.
Sure.
the community, and especially the clans, to decide what they wanted to do. And they met and they decided.
Did you have the opportunity to go to the reburial or go to the site now where the remains are? Have you had that chance?
I haven't.
No.
The cast and crew got to go and visit when they were on tour with the show in the Yukon.
Okay.
Went through Dawson. They got to hear the talk. No, they didn't. Sorry. But Greg Hare was up there before the production arrived as well, and they did the presentation. But I haven't had the opportunity. And the burial itself, the reburial, the dedication ceremony was all done with family, with very close.
A private ceremony, yeah. Because there seems to be a lot of meaning in this, because, you know, the tradition, wanting to follow these traditional, the burial, and, you know, as you talked about, this very strong community bond in these various clans, these various villages across the north is very strong, and that comes through clearly when you're reading about this story, and in the play, then I would assume I haven't seen. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm coming next week.
Me too.
So I assume that's maybe, you know, one of the big themes that comes out of it.
The
strength of this culture that. It's not a settler, like the Canada isn't the settler history, that it has this other history of this strong, like you say, strong people who have been here for thousands of years as part of reclaiming that history a little bit.
Well, I hope it does to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the definitive word on the history and the culture of these peoples. It is my, after all, interpretation of what I've researched. But I think it's a window on how indigenous justice systems differ from the mainstream justice system. And hopefully it gets people thinking of what, you know, why, how, when, where, all those questions. So hopefully it raises these questions in people's minds and we can actually get into some sort of discussion about it. You know, why are indigenous people overrepresented in the mainstream justice system? And can things work better? For not just for indigenous people, but for the whole of society.
So do you feel as though you're challenging audiences to rethink their sort of their preconceived notions of maybe First Nations communities or with the North or the justice system? Is that part of what you're doing here?
I don't know if I'm challenging. I think I'm hoping that a conversation strikes up. I don't want to be challenging people.
Right.
I know where the question comes from, but I think the language is a powerful thing. And when you're challenging, it sounds almost like conflict. I think we want to work together and walk together.
Right. Create a dialogue then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If we could create a dialogue and hopefully something better grows out of it all, that would be great. Mm. But I find that the people who do go to theater are generally that type of people anyway. You know, they think about things and they want to be presented with new information.
Right.
They welcome it.
Right.
And
you want to question things. And, like, you know, open yourself up to new opportunities, new perspectives.
Yes.
And sort of question what you already know.
Yeah. And that's why I love theater.
Yeah.
You know, that's the reason I'm in it. I mean, I'm a journalist. I deal in conflict every day, you know. But as a theater practitioner, I mean, when I was going to school, this is where I really appreciated theater, because we were taught how to solve problems, and the best way of solving problems is to remove yourself from them, right?
Right.
Take a step back and look at the whole picture. And when you do that, you basically got the story on a stage. Mm. Yeah, that's what you're looking
for. Right.
And that's what theater is a story on a stage. Mm. It's the best way of dealing with problems, I think, is removing yourself and looking at it from outside.
And it creates a very powerful experience for the audience as well.
Let's hope so.
Yeah,
it's cathartic. cathartic, as as they say. It can be, and that depends a lot on the artists involved. Theater, I might write the words, but you know, you got the lighting, you got the sound, you got the actors, you got the director. You know, the whole thing comes together, and then hopefully it does end up in something powerful.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like a great show, so I'm really looking forward to seeing it next week.
I'm amazed at what these guys are doing.
Yeah, I had a chance to meet a few of them here. It seems like a really talented, enthusiastic bunch.
They're amazing. They're great artists. Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. So, Leonard Linklater, playwright of Justice, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And next up on this three-part podcast, we'll shift to the Hexagon Studio at the National Arts Center, where I had the opportunity to talk with Greg Hare, chief archaeologist of the Yukon, and we'll pick up our conversation as we talk about the discovery of the human remains in Dawson City.
So I have the two. So it was Dawson and Jim. The two names that I got were the two that were hanged, and then Frank and Joe were the two that died of tuberculosis. So
that's right.
They get hanged, and then 112 years later, on November 4th, 2010, what happens?
Well, that's actually where my involvement in the story begins, because I'm an archaeologist for the Yukon government, and on November the 4th, we had a telephone call from Dawson City, quite an alarming telephone call, that during the process of excavating for a new sewage treatment facility in downtown Dawson, the backhoe operator accidentally uncovered some wooden coffin remains and skeletal material and clothing and things like that. So work was immediately stopped on the site, and I flew up to Dawson the following day and became involved in the recovery and the identification of the skeletal material that had been uncovered.
Now, as an archaeologist, what is it like to get a call like that? That we found some bones, we found some remains, we need you to get here as soon as you can. What's that feeling for you and as you're in the process of going to the site? What's going through your mind during that time?
Well, it's not an entirely unheard of situation that we fairly frequently get reports of exposed burials and human remains becoming eroded out of a bank or something like that, usually in the context of a river that is moving along and taking away a riverbank, and people often in days gone by were buried alongside rivers. But in this situation, that it became obvious fairly quickly that we were in the heart of downtown Dawson. We were also in a location that had been the center of Fort Herkimer, which was the Northwest Mounted Police Post for Dawson during the Klondike Gold Rush. And we already knew, we were aware of the historical significance of Fort Herkimer, and we knew that a number of people had been executed by hanging during the Gold Rush, and they had been marked in unmarked burials within, we thought, within the confines of Fort Herkimer. So already, as soon as that first call came in, things started to click into place that this is probably the location of this unmarked graveyard or cemetery that was connected with the Klondike Gold Rush execution. So what complicates the story in the Yukon always, especially in November, is that it was minus 20 the day the discovery was made. November in Dawson, the days are quite short. The darkness comes early, and it was getting colder and colder, so that while the backhoe operator was able to dig in the ground, it wasn't frozen once you got a foot or two down into the ground. With temperatures of minus 20 and minus 30, that is, if the ground was being left exposed for very long at all, then everything was frozen solid. So when I got up to Dawson, I looked at the situation and conferred with the Tron DeQuichen the local First Nation and the mm-hmm. developer, and we decided that this was a situation that needed an emergency salvage recovery in view of the temperatures and the exposed bones being sort of littering the excavation. And also, this was a major development project. This was a multi-million dollar sewage treatment facility mm-hmm. that was needed and was being held up by this development. So at that point, in consultation with the Toronto Gwich'in, we decided to mount an emergency recovery of these remains, and we put together a volunteer force of people, and we spent the next approximately week recovering burials from this location.
So what was that process like, putting together a team to do this? Because you're somewhat isolated up there, and I would assume that you don't have a lot of people with archaeological experience, but given the sensitivity of this particular situation, I guess any situation where you're finding human remains is pretty sensitive, I would assume. But, the need to do this quickly versus the need to do it properly, I mean, how do you find that balance in mobilizing a volunteer crew, and especially the size of a crew that you would need to for this dig, given the oncoming winter and the need to do it quickly?
I think you're hitting the nose right on the head there. All the comments you're making were the things that we had to deal with. That nobody really had any archaeology experience. The conditions were adverse, but the community, I can't emphasize how well the community pulled together on that event. We had people from the nursing station. We had people working who worked for the developer, for the First Nation, for the city of Dawson. And everybody really dropped what they were doing. And we didn't know what we were up against at first. The first swipe of the bucket really uncovered partial remains of two coffins and two individuals, and over the next week or so it turned into more than that. By the time we were finished, there were four different coffins and four different individuals that were uncovered, but really the conditions are adverse, and it wouldn't have been possible to find a crew that would have been properly trained that would have probably worked in those conditions. That what we ended up doing was setting up screens in the bottom of the pit, and we had people, much of the initial discovery had disturbed two of the coffins significantly, so we right. had bones and clothing scattered throughout this very large excavation, so we had to shovel that material into buckets and then carry the buckets down into the screens in the bottom of the pit. Meanwhile, we had people who were excavating into the side hill to recover the bones, the intact or in situ bones that were still in the side of the excavation. Meanwhile, we had material that had already been moved off site, because there had been a couple of bucket loads that had gone into a dump truck that had been taken off the site. So we had another crew working out in that area, screening through the waste piles to try to find bones that had been uncovered there. And as it got colder, we had to use insulated tarps to lay down to try to keep the ground from freezing. And eventually we ended up having to put large tent frames up with Herman Nelson heaters, or these large kerosene-powered heaters to try to keep the ground from freezing. We had diesel-powered light generators that provided light so that we could work early in the morning and well into the night to try to get this all done before the ground was frozen solid.
And how long did that process take?
It took about probably a week for the first go around, and then we thought we had finished. We had three complete graves, and then about a day or two later, the same backhoe operator working in another area hit another grave. So we were back at it again for another couple of days. So I'd say the whole process was about 10 days in total.
Okay. Well, that backhoe operator, that's a skill right there.
That's right. Jeez. Yeah, he was working very carefully after that point. And from that point, my colleague Chris Thomas and I, we basically spent the next week up there afterwards, and every bucket of the backhoe that was scraping was observed, so that nothing else was going to be uncovered that we weren't aware of.
So you find these remains and you get them, then they're sent off, and we're going to talk to Susan Mooney about the analysis of the bones and identifying who these people were. But just for you, being in Dawson City for that dig, what was the reaction locally? You talked about how people were eager to help out and volunteer, but you know, once it was clear what was going on and who these remains were, what was the reaction locally?
Well, I have to say that initially it wasn't clear who these were.
Right.
Initially, we knew that this was very likely the people who had been executed by hanging, but we knew there were 10 individuals who had been executed, and we had the remains. At first, we had the remains of three of these, so it was a process of elimination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a local historian, amateur historian, who worked at the Dawson Nursing Station, who was well-versed in the history of the people who had been executed, and he had numerous theories. Each day the theory seemed to change about who the individuals were, and it received a lot of national media coverage at the time. So on any particular day you could turn on the radio and hear who it was being speculated that had been dug up the day before. So we didn't really know. I have to say that, you know, as an archaeologist, there were a couple of, you know, indicators that I had observed when we were recovering the very first remains that gave a strong indication, because we knew of the 10 people who had been executed, seven were Caucasian, two were First Nations, and one was of Asian ancestry. And when I was doing one of the recoveries, I could see from the skeletal material that this person had teeth that were what we call shovel-shaped, so that the front incisors were of a particular configuration that strongly suggested that the individual was either First Nation or of Asian ancestry.
Okay.
So I had an indication early on, but it wasn't until Susan Mooney came up and began doing the full osteological analysis that we were able to confirm who each of the individuals were. So it certainly wasn't a straightforward exercise. We didn't know right away who it was.
You know, being part of this process, being part of the story, I mean, you know, not to say that you've really interjected yourself. I don't want to make it seem like that, but you really were part of the story and all the news that was coming out. You were quoted in all the articles, and you really became a main fixture in this story. So I'm curious, on a personal level, now that you're so closely associated with this one because of this dig with the Nantuck story, how has the story changed for you and your understanding of it?
I'm not sure exactly how to answer that. I think that some of the things that resonate most with me are the level of community participation and the cooperative, collaborative working relationship with the First Nation. Like I said earlier, that I've recovered a number of skeletons or bodies or whatever through the years, so it's not like a tremendous rush for me to be involved with human remains necessarily.
Right.
What was really different was how committed the community and the First Nation were to resolving this situation in a collaborative, respectful way. And I, you know, at the end of the process, I just felt that I had made a whole lot of new friends, and that in a really respectful, open way, and that you know, if nothing else, that at the end of the day, I felt that we were all closer together and understood, you know, what we'd all been through together. I think for some of the people involved, and I know for some of the people involved, they were very moved. They were very distressed by what they had experienced and some of the things we had seen. And I know people who were not familiar with that kind of thing before, were deeply moved by it. So I think that for everybody, the experience was different. But from a group perspective, it was really amazing how everybody pulled together from different. We had the fire chief was out there. We had the nurse from the hospital who was working there. The First Nation Heritage members were there. We had elders. It was a great community effort.
Well, that's great that something like this can really, build this community atmosphere, because I think that's one of the things that history has the power to do, and especially in a community like Dawson City. Or really anywhere that's maybe a little more isolated, which is a word I hate to use, but I'll use it anyway. Mm-hmm. This ability to bring people together and foster a community spirit, and despite the fact that it's with an execution, the fact that you can come in and help along with the community and be part of this larger process, I think that's a really good sign and shows what history can do and what it can be for a city or community.
I totally agree. And one of the other things that I think is important in this whole story is that we were involved in the recovery of these historic figures that had these characters that were involved here, these people who had been executed. Really, the history, the stories of these people had been kept alive for almost more than 100 years. Mm-hmm. On two different levels, like your standard history textbooks often referred to the Nantuck brothers and referred to the sort of cultures in conflict and really the justice system of the day and whether or not justice had been served in this situation. But at the same time, these stories lived on in First Nation oral traditions. And Julie Cruikshank, back in the, I think, late 1960s, early 1970s, had chronicled from First Nation oral traditions the stories of these Nantuck brothers and how they ended up on the wrong side of the law, let's say, and being executed, and what that had meant to the First Nations of the time. So what's really remarkable is this was a story that had continued on these two separate spheres, the historical record and the First Nation oral traditions, and here we were 100 and some years later, and the two of the first three graves that we encounter in this situation are these two individuals, the Nantuck brothers, that had been so well documented in both cultural spheres like that.
Yeah. And that's sort of what you mentioned, how it was a very powerful experience for people. I mean, it's a personal thing. Even though this happened 110 years ago, it's still a very personal experience. People are attaching themselves to the story, and it's really remarkable that can still be the case.
That's right. And there are any number of individuals in the Yukon who can trace their ancestry or their lineage to some of these Nantuck brothers. So when we had the reburial ceremony the following year, a number of individuals attended the service, the ceremony, the burial ceremony, that were related to, in some way, to the Nantucks.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable story, and I'm thrilled to have you on to talk about your part of it. So thanks for doing this, Greg.
Oh, you're very welcome, Sean.
Thanks. So that's Greg Hare, Yukon Senior Archaeologist. And now we will welcome in Susan Moorhead Mooney, who is from Yukon College in Whitehorse. She was the osteologist as part of the Nantuck dig. Welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Now, we just talked to Greg, and he talked about some of the logistical problems from his perspective in terms of the weather and having people who were experienced enough to participate in an archaeological dig. Now, from your perspective as the osteologist, and we'll just clarify, the osteologist, the person who looks at the remains and tries to figure out who it is, right?
That's right.
So from your perspective as the osteologist, what were some of the logistical problems for you with respect to the Nantuck dig?
Well, I think the biggest constraint we had was that we only had, we had less than 48 hours to do a full skeletal analysis to try and come up with enough clues to figure out who they were.
Okay, and how long would that process normally take?
Typically, you could spend a couple weeks on each individual. going over just a variety of things. But at a salvage project like this was, we really had to step it up and really look at the age at death, the sex, whether they were male or female, any initial observations that we might have, and that would include all sorts of things, pathology, cultural markers, that sort of thing. So we were flying.
When you talk about this, trying to identify male, female, or cultural markers, any of these things, I mean, I go to a museum and I see bones, and they all look the exact same to me. So what exactly is the process, and what are you looking for to help identify remains that are, at the time, they're over 110 years old?
That's right. We're looking for anything that might give us a clue that would match up either to an oral history or a historical document. So a good example of that might be Edward Henderson. We knew right away from looking at his skull, and particularly his dentition, that he was from outside the territory, typically for being somebody from 1898, because he had incredible dental work. And we're not saying that there weren't incredible dentists in Dawson City at the time, but likely the techniques that were used to make this gold bridge in his mouth and put this porcelain veneer on likely came from someplace in a larger center.
Oh, wow. So even though there isn't a dental record to necessarily match it up with, you take what you know about what was going on in Dawson City at the time to compare to what he had.
Exactly.
So, you know, in that respect then, how much of what you do is dependent on, I'll use traditional for the lack of a better term, traditional historical research in terms of archives or oral histories? You know, how much do you need that to support the science?
It really depends on the individual case when it comes to osteology. Sometimes you end up with a lot of clues. I would say we had a moderate number of clues in this case for each of these individuals. In fact, of the four that were recovered at the salvage site there with the wastewater treatment facility, we had one that was only present from his waist down. And
right.
So we weren't able to say a lot about him. What I could say is he was about 5'6" to 5'7". He had very marked muscles on his legs, indicating he was probably a little overweight or he was a little bodybuilder. we also knew from his bones he was over 50 years old. And there were only two people that were hanged in Dawson who were over 50 years of age. And we couldn't definitively assign an identity to that individual. However, he does most likely match up with Alexander King in my mind. That said, I did leave him unassigned with the thought that he could be another guy named Ned Alfors, but he doesn't match up as well with the historical records from the newspaper. And the problem with that is you got to let the bones tell their own story.
Right.
Sometimes the oral histories and sometimes, you know, the historical documents such as the newspapers, they'll get it wrong, just like, you know, that happens today.
Yeah.
Witness accounts are sometimes wrong. Sometimes the stories are don't match up. But in this case, my gut's telling me that it's probably Alexander King. It's just I can't say that definitively.
And you mentioned that you could tell that they're over 50 years old. Exactly how can you do that?
In this case, we had a really good, what we call pubic symphysis. So that's the pubis bone just at the front there of your groin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some very good osteological standards that have been in place that most osteologists use probably for the last 40 years now that we go by. And it's a typical standard. And when I say that, it does vary by population. But in this case, it matched up quite well.
So I'm also wondering, in talking about your cultural markings in this, and I've read some of the newspaper articles that were published during the dig, and you're quoted as talking about, and other people as well, talking about some of the, again, these cultural markers that helped you verify that two of the remains were indeed the Nantuck brothers who were executed. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what some of those cultural markers would be that would distinguish the Nantuck brothers from the prospectors.
We didn't have that much as far as cultural markers. We did have some some osteological or pathological markers, and we also had what we call metric traits. And when you look at metric traits, again, they're based on population basis, on many, many studies that a lot of individuals have done over the course of many years. One of the key things that we noticed right away about the Nantuck brothers is that they both had shovel-shaped incisors, which is a big indicator that someone has ancestry that is First Nations or Asian. And it was that coupled with the fact that we had one of the Nantuck brothers, Dawson Nantuck, completely in situ, which means undisturbed. We had very, very good preservation of his clothing.
Okay.
So that matched up almost, it matched up very well with what the boys were wearing in the picture that everyone sees in the newspapers of the Nantuck brothers.
Can I just say that that's amazing that a shirt or something can last 110 years in the ground and I can't get it to last 2 years in my closet? That's remarkable to me. I don't mean this question to challenge anything, but how certain are we that these guys are who we think they are, as opposed to, you know, just somebody who may have been buried there 100 years earlier or 50 years earlier? Like to what degree can we be certain that these, at least the three individuals who are identified, the fourth who you think you have a strong inclination of who it is, to what degree of certainty can we determine that these guys are who we think they are?
Fairly certain. I'd put it up there fairly high. Nothing in archaeology and osteology is ever going to be 100%. It is science. So, you know, we're constantly trying to support our theories.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to defeat our theories, but it's harder to support. You need much more evidence to support. So we're fairly certain. The reason we're fairly certain is we did have hoods over. We had hood material for the two bodies that were commingled, and that was Edward Henderson and Jim Nantuck. And we had a full head that was covered in a hood for Dawson Nantuck, the in-situ burial.
Okay.
So we knew right away that we had hanging victims. The other thing we had is we had some records indicating where these individuals may have been buried. Now, originally they were thought to be in another spot on Fort Herkimer grounds, but we did come across some Northwest Mounted Police information indicating where they might be. We also know from archaeological technique and just doing this a fair amount that three individuals were buried at the same time, and that was the Henderson and the Dawson and Jim Nantuck. We know from the historical records there was only one case in Fort Herkimer history where there were three individuals hanged at the same time, presumably interred at the same time. That is what we found in the excavation. So we had that information. Now, mind you, that was information that I purposely didn't want to know until after I did the osteological analysis, because I need to go into these things blind. Again, the bones tell their own story, and they need to be allowed to tell their own story and not have me put something on that because I've been told something from somebody else. Going in, we knew that two individuals had been commingled. We didn't know who they were. We knew virtually nothing except for the fact that we had evidence of hanging. We had bindings above and below the knees. We had really well-preserved bones, hair, and teeth, and clothing. When we went to separate the two individuals that were commingled, the interesting thing there was typically you'd be able to separate them on size, but these two individuals were almost identical in how tall they were. They were right around 5'10", both of them. So the next thing I looked at was, do we have one that's, you know, significantly older than the other? And not really. We had third molars that were erupted for both individuals. We had all the bones had fused completely for adult growth, indicating that, you know, they were full adults.
Yeah.
So moving on from there, we had to go to secondary pieces. And we noticed that the lime that had been poured into the burials after these individuals were put in the coffins, and I should back up, the practice of the day had been to put someone in a coffin, pack the lime around them, pour water over the top of that, let it turn into a frothing mess, and then nail the coffin lid on, and then bury immediately.
Well, that doesn't sound very pleasant.
No, it's not very pleasant. And people have asked me, well, why did they do that? There's a couple reasons why that was done. One was to cut down on the odor. If you recall, lime was readily available in most places for outhouses, and it was used for an odor control substance. Mm-hmm. But the other reason was these were some of the first hangings in the Yukon that were sanctioned by the court. And these followed whatever the practice of the day was in Canada. Well, at the time, it was the practice to try and cut down on the grief for the victim's family as quickly as possible. And also, you've got to remember, this is Dawson City. This is the home of the sour toe cocktail. And listeners can look that up. But, you know, people will rob graves for various reasons. So this was thought to cut down on those sorts of things as well. In our case, what it did is it provided phenomenal preservation. And when we were trying to separate the two commingled individuals, we noticed that there was blue staining on some elements, and quickly we put the blue elements together and realized that we had only a single individual. And so from there, we surmised that one individual probably was wearing cotton jeans over the top of his wool underwear when he was hanged, and the other one was not. So that was one clue to us.
Okay.
But both individuals had wool underwear on, which I find very interesting because these individuals were hanged in August. And inside the wool clothing was leg hair. And we were able to ascertain that one individual had brown hair and the other one had black.
Oh, wow.
So that helped us as well separate the two individuals out. And from there, we were able to match skeletal elements.
And is there any chance with you know, or at least with the Nantuck brothers, they would have descendants. Was there any opportunity to maybe do DNA or anything like that?
That was, now I was wearing two hats when I was working as the osteologist. I was the manager at Carcross Tagish First Nation, and there was a process, absolutely, of going back to the First Nation and asking, you know, what they wanted to see done before reburial and, you know, where reburial would take place. There was a number of elders. The Elders Council was consulted with. They did take a number of meetings to discuss this issue. And some individuals were in favor of doing DNA analysis. But in the end, it was decided that the DNA analysis was not something that was in line with traditional beliefs and values. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we know as much as we need to know at this point. And we do not need to do DNA.
Well, that makes sense. Just leave it to the community, the people who are really connected to this, and it's a personal story. That makes sense to me to leave it to them.
Absolutely.
Now, just on a personal note for you, this story has gotten some pretty widespread recognition across the country, some notoriety. Just what has it been like for you, not just as an expert, as an osteologist, but just as a person to be involved in such a major story across the country?
It's humbling, and it's also, I feel very honored. And I say that because, you know, I was entrusted with in trying to help identify these people. And, you know, there are large social justice implications with this case back in the day, and it echoes even today. And all I can say is I've felt very honored, and there's been a lot of press about this. There's many, many different aspects of this story, and the Nantucks are one piece of it. Ed Henderson's another piece. Alexander King and Ned Alfors are another piece, and with wide-ranging connections to a variety of geographic areas.
I think, well, that's it's a really interesting story, and I think that's a perfect note to leave it on. So that's Susan Moorhead Mooney from Yukon College, the osteologist on the Nantuck Dig. Thanks a lot for doing this, Susan.
Thank you so much, Sean.
So there you have it. Three different perspectives on the Nantuck brothers and the story.
Now, as Leonard Linklater said, by no means is this the definitive account of the Nantuck brothers and their story. So I would encourage everybody to go out, do a little bit of research, and do a little bit of reading on the story, because it really is a fascinating tale, and there's so many layers to the story, and the deeper you get into it, you realize how complex all the issues really are. And if you're in the National Capital Region, be sure to check out Justice. It's playing May 2nd through 4th, 8 p.m. each night at Arts Court in the theater. My thanks to Leonard Linklater, Greg Hare, Susan Moorhead Mooney. Also, I'd like to thank Martin at the Hexagon Studio at the National Arts Center, and also Marnie Richardson. As well, I'd like to thank Carla Wolf and Laura Denker for their assistance in setting everything up. If you have questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter @DrShawneeFever. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode as part of our Northern History Week here at activehistory.ca. But in the meantime, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.